She singles him out, Jerome, Saint Jerome, in a poem. Jerome is known as a translator, one who translated most of the Bible into Latin. She writes, "And glorious Jerome, he drove his pen across a sheet of foolscap heavy as stone. Jerome and his hand curled around a stylo or quill with a loose white feather." That from the poem Black Letter Vulgate in the Antioch Review, a poem by Jean McGarry. Jerome here making the mysteries of God more accessible and understandable. There is no poem for John of Patmos, though, yet there may be echoes there too. He sees the city coming down from above, the heavenly Jerusalem, and he writes too of the gates and the streets and the walls, and he knew with precision the measurement of this city as he came to write his book of Revelation, the Apocalypse. Apocalypse, as Charles Strozer reminds us, is a transliteration of a Greek word meaning to uncover and disclose. And we might suggest Jean McGarry is an earthly revelator in a sense. It's not Patmos in this case, or the heavenly Jerusalem, but mostly Providence. Providence, Rhode Island, her hometown, and she, as a writer, has been taking its measure. And she lifts her pen. She still, we're told, writes with pens, a celebration of penmanship she learned from the nuns in her youth. And she chronicles and reveals lives like this, as her character Maddie describes them in the story collection Ocean State. "As I always pulled my heavy legs up the narrow, curved and carpeted stairs, I always stopped to look out the window, although what was there but a dumb dog, Lucky or Brutus, lollygagging up the street, or the McInerney's house, with shades still down at 12 noon. What were they doing in there? It was a pigsty, I'd heard my mother say, a hell hole. Later, though, the shades would fly up, the lights come on, and cars line the street. The McInerneys, as we called them, were always having company. What do they do, my mother wanted to know, crowding me out of the window to get an eyeful. Sweep it all under the rug?" That from a story by Jean McGarry. Jean McGarry has thought about this raising of the shades in writing, and she reminds us of what E.M. Forster says about the novel. "We cannot understand each other except in a rough and ready way. We cannot reveal ourselves even when we want to. What we call intimacy is only makeshift. Perfect knowledge is an illusion. But in a novel we can know people perfectly, and apart from the general pleasures of reading, we can find here a compensation for their dimness in life." That from an essay titled Civility in Dublin by Jean McGarry in MLN, December 1986. Jean McGarry is an award-winning author with a number of books of fiction. Her short stories have appeared in The New Yorker, The Yale Review, The Southwest Review, and more. She has been a newspaper reporter and translator, and she is currently Elliot Coleman Professor at Johns Hopkins, where she has co-chaired the writing seminars. Jean McGarry will be the featured author as the Allen Hamilton Dixon Spring Writers Series continues this Tuesday, April 17th, at Wilkes University in Wilkes-Barre. She will read from her work and talk about her creative process. We had a chance to speak by phone with Jean McGarry about her writing life.
The funny thing was, I wasn't even a particularly good writer. I didn't even like to write. You know, I wrote a few things that the nuns approved of. I was a good student, but there was a Rhode Island connection here. I had gone to all parochial schools, you know, up to grade 12, well, actually grade 14, because I went to a Catholic college. I transferred to Harvard, and I thought, for the first time in my life, I thought nobody would believe what my childhood was like, because it was so different from anybody else's. And I think that's when I first started thinking about writing. Here's the funny thing. I had in mind a character, a boy I had grown up, you know, as a classmate, and it took me almost a whole lifetime to get him into a story, but he might have been the origin because I thought, you know, he was a Kennedy-like character, but kind of on the low end of the income spectrum. And everyone in the city looked up to this family for reasons I never really entirely understood. So when I finally, you know, developed enough technique that I could take on any subject from that era, I finally wrote the story. It's in Ocean State. It's called Dream Date. And I think what it took to put him on the page was recreate the character that stood for myself. You know, so instead of sort of a drab watcher and listener, you know, I created a character that was kind of a foil to him and a collaborator. And it was weird and great moment of success to think, oh, here's the origin of everything. And it's finally on the page. And then the other thing that's kind of strange is that the nuns who played a huge role in my growing up, I didn't really write about them until my most recent book, No Harm Done. So, I mean, it's interesting to me how long these things take to germinate. But I think in my case, I became a writer because I had something to say. And when I'm sometimes teaching, I get the sense that some of my students want to be writers, but they're not burning with a subject, and I think I was.
You really want to find a form, so not just that you can describe it, but so maybe they could feel it in a way.
Right, exactly. And then when I graduated from Harvard and, you know, began my long journey to find my way, I found that people really wouldn't understand what it was like to be at Harvard in the late 60s. So I wrote another book because I thought, now, you know, I kind of in some ways lost faith in telling stories aloud because I thought, no, you can never get it exactly right. But if you wait long enough and you write about it, you can. And that was, I think, my motivation almost all the time was thinking, you know, nobody would really believe this unless I really work on it.
And what was it in your reading that suggested that literature has that power?
Well, I think I was a reader from a very early age because it was a great way to escape from everything. And if anything, I've become almost an obsessive, constant reader now. I mean, books, I can get so distracted when I'm reading a book, I forget everything around me. So I guess I thought if I could produce that experience for somebody else, and in addition, convey what I had seen and felt, I would just feel this tremendous sense of fulfillment. And I was right, I did. It took a long time, but a lot of what I've wanted to do, I've done. And I thought, I haven't often heard anybody say that. You know, the other thing that's kind of funny is, because I did so much reading, I really thought I was going to be a writer of upper middle class professional and intellectual life. I thought, because I was interested in that. And then I started writing stories, and I showed them to some friends, and they said, you know, you really don't know enough about, you don't even know what these people drink. And I thought, okay. So I went back to writing about what I did know. And some people have not criticized me, but they've said, you know, you probably would have been more successful as a writer if you hadn't chosen a subject that's so, not obscure, but so kind of rarefied in a way, or that people, but I thought, no, I had to, this is what I had to, this is what I was put on earth to do.
You must believe very strongly in the power of language. And were you in parochial school at the time when language was Latin in church and the power of those words was almost mystical or sacramental in some way?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I think the only place in my life where there was any culture was in the church. You know, there were paintings, there was Gregorian chant, there were costumes, there was incense. I mean, there was just everything about it was very magical. And I embraced it wholly. You know, I just thought, so to speak, I just thought, this is great. So, yeah, that it played a large role. And I think it took me a long time, since I'm really no longer a practicing Catholic, but it took me a long time to figure out, where does that fit in my stories? I think that's why it took me a while. Even though my first story was about a priest, it took me a long time to take on the nuns, who I was much closer to.
And are these nuns, when you did come to write about them, very much fragile vessels? We know all kinds of different nuns.
That's a very interesting question. I mean, they were really, again, they were oddities because they were an Irish order from Ireland or from Canada. They were semi-cloistered, so we never saw them eat. They were completely covered in fabric, and they were very fierce and extremely moralistic. I mean, most nuns would be like that, but They weren't socially progressive the way the nuns on the barricades are. They were more of a contemplative order. And really, their only social life was us, was coming to school. And so in that way, they were also very fascinating to me. They were living in a world that just seemed magical.
And you have a sense of fantasy, don't you, in telling stories? Is it related to that?
I think the fantasy is imagining what other people's lives are like. And I not only do that, I try to imagine what their lives are like from the inside. What else could that be but fantasy? Because you can't know. But I guess as a kid, I did a lot of watching. And I think I was fascinated by incongruities. I would hear people say one thing and then do another. Or I was so simple-minded in a way that I thought, if they say this and they do this, what could they be like? And when I was really young, when I would see incongruities like that, I would just speak them out. And I learned after a while, people didn't want to hear this. But when I would write it up in a story as an adult, it would seem funny. My first book is very much autobiographical, and it's about my family, but I thought of it as a comic treatment. I still do. I never thought they would see it because, a university press, I thought, they're not going to find this book. Well, the Providence Journal wrote a huge article in the book section on it, and they couldn't wait to buy it. And then they were terribly hurt, and I felt very badly about that. But after a while, they sort of became collaborators. I mean, shortly after this book came out, which is called Heirs of Providence, my brother made a kind of a draftsman-like map of our neighborhood with the names of not only all the stores and who lived there, and it with such great detail. And I thought, this is his version of my book, and I have it on my wall. I loved it. I realized, even though I'm the only writer in the family, that we're all kind of absorbed in the past in a way that I don't think other people. When I've gotten to know other people very well, I find they don't remember their childhoods very well. We remember everything. And it wasn't because it was so good. It was interesting. And somehow we never really left Providence.
What about the sense of place, then? It's so important to some writers, and we hear you always identified. It's Jean McGarry from Providence,
right.
Jean McGarry from Rhode Island. People want to place you when they describe you.
Well, and also, one of my books is called Ocean State, which is what's on the license plates, Rhode Island. Yes, and it's funny. Some of my work is descriptive. Some of it has landscape built into it or setting. But I think it was more the talk of Providence, the way that people talk. And, when I finally got to Ireland as an adult, I realized it was the connection that people talked all the time there, and their world was the world of speech as much as anything. I mean, I remember sitting in a coffee shop in Dublin and watching the same people walk up and down the street as they were talking. And this was in the 90s. This was like in the 60s. And I thought, wow, this is where it all comes from. So at any rate, my place is really a place of speech. I mean, the ocean, of course, played a large part. And it is a very interesting-looking state. It has forest, and it's really a lovely place. But I left at 18 and really never lived there again. I agree with what you're saying. For some people, like for Joyce, who, of course, was a model for me, he left Dublin in his 20s, lived in Paris and Trieste and different places, and he only wrote about Ireland. And he didn't decide to write about Paris. So just the Irish culture, it really sticks to you.
And I'm struck by the image of your brother's map and the way in some conversations you've had, interviews, where you talk about where you've gotten in your writing. And that's not a place in terms of geography, but there is ground that you've covered and re-explored or maybe come to freshly?
Yes, and that definitely has happened to me in that when I've written several collections of books that kind of depict life in Providence over time, so that Ocean State, the point of view on lives is so different from Heirs of Providence because I saw more of the lives. And I don't know, probably this has to do with the aging process, but I mean, I could see some things more tenderly, which I hadn't had. I'm not terribly sentimental, and I really kind of got an edge. But by maybe my 50s and taking up the subject again and seeing people's lives extend to, late adulthood, the stories were different. And I was so glad to see that because I thought, I don't want to just be taking a rake over everything. I wanted to see if there was something to appreciate, and there was.
And this notion of speech that you laid out for us and how important that is, I asked you in an email about your musical experience. Did you study music? Did you play music? And how does that relate to you as a writer?
Well, you know, it goes back to Providence. I always wanted to play the piano. The nuns offered piano lessons in the convent, and I thought that was just the ultimate. But my parents both didn't have the money, but also they just weren't that engaged in music, so they didn't think this was that important. But I made myself a paper keyboard because I thought, this is what I really, you know. And the funny thing is, I still have dreams about having a piano. But what happened just in time was I had a friend when I graduated from college, and this is late in life for a musician, as I know you know. But he played the guitar, and he taught me how to play. And once I learned the repertoire of folk and blues, I knew that I was more interested in classical guitar. So I got a classical guitar, and I enrolled as a music student at UC Irvine. And I loved it. I mean, if I could start out again at 3 years old, and if I had found that I had the talent, I would have gone in that direction, because it's even more absorbing than writing.
What did you play then? Were you playing things like the Spanish composers, Soar?
That's exactly right. Soar, Giuliani, the Spanish composers, Bach, a lot of Bach. I loved Bach. And it just was very important to me because it was such a concentrated thing to do if you were trying to catch up, which is what I was doing, and I just spend hours in the practice room, you know, just playing things over and over. I don't always get a chance to tell my students this, but I think learning how to play an instrument is very important for a writer, because you lose certain things. Music has a lot of meaning and feeling, but it doesn't have any sense, you know. So you have to work with, in some ways, a limited vocabulary, and you have to make that convey something, you know, connected to the past. And it was a great interlude for me. I did it seriously for 4 years, and it just was thrilling.
And how about your ear for dialogue then, and rhythm and so forth, that is so much a part of writing?
Well, you know, it's so important to me that I don't usually start a story unless I have a first sentence that has a certain rhythmic quality. It has certain words in it as well, but I mean, it has a certain energy, and I can go from there. And then, you know, just very quickly, the characters are there and the other things. But the feeling, the music of the opening is very important to me. And having to do with dialogue, I now realize why I can remember how people talk pretty well. When I hear a piece of music, I can get it into my head and I can't get it out for days. It's actually a nuisance now. I think the technical term for it is an earworm. And I think the earworm, which can be a torment, is probably why I've been able to do what I've done as far as reproducing people's speech. At this translation conference that I mentioned in my letter to you, there were people there who had six languages, and I was just wowed by this. And I talked to them about it, and one of these speakers said, well, you know, my father is an opera singer, and my grandfather played the oboe, and I thought, I bet that's the connection. But I guess the other thing he said is my father had perfect pitch. And I thought, oh. And I thought, well, why did I began to think, I don't have that ability with languages. And I thought, well, I don't have that, but I got this other thing. But I think they're all connected.
Again, we go back to the importance of speech for you as a writer. You are a listener as well as an observer. You talked about being a young one watching and observing, but you were listening and absorbing on all those levels in that way. Now, how does that relate to journalism then?
Well, journalism, like music, was a great discipline for me, because it was a good way to very quickly rid your writing of any excess, because they didn't really want, even though I was mainly a feature writer, there was not a lot of playing with. There was no jargon. I mean, your prose got really scoured. That was good for me. And the other thing that I loved about it is I got to ask the questions rather than have to answer them. I loved going out and just digging in. But, you know, you mentioned in your note the movie The Post, which I haven't seen. But I think I was more interested in the old movies, you know, His Gal Friday and novels like Miss Lonely Hearts. I thought, again, this connects to Providence. It brought back to me the past, a past that that my family had had and that I didn't have, because even though Rhode Island was such an old-fashioned place, we were still in the 20th century, you know. And the newspaper world was still in the Industrial Revolution, at least when I started out, and they had hot type and a composing room and all. You know, I felt like I was sort of in the 19th century, and I loved that. You know, my father was a great reader of newspaper. I mean, the newspaper was, for him, the Bible. It was the Providence Journal. So I think I got a feeling for how important it was to people. My brother delivered newspapers. It was maybe the textual part of our lives. And I was not that factual a person, so I never was the person they sent to the State House. But it was a world that was very attractive to me. And even when I was doing it, I thought, there's a novel in this, because I saw the world changing so rapidly. You know, the hot type going to photographic methods and quickly to computer and that changed the nature of it. And I could see that that was happening. So it was exciting.
What do people say to you now? Do they get in touch reading Gallagher's travels?
Well, you know, it's so interesting you should say that. I think the thing that's interesting about that book is it could connect to the Me Too movement, because journalism was the sexual harassment cultural capital. I mean, it was, especially when I was in Detroit, I mean, it really was just taken for granted. There were few women who were on newspaper staff, and this was just part of daily life. And how one coped with it, well, how I coped with it was with humor, and that's how the book copes with it. But it's just interesting to see, you know, that's another way in which the business is being upended, because the old way of operating is just no longer to be tolerated. Gallagher's Travels is arcana. You know, I mean, it's just... But also, the newspaper, the one I worked for, there was a very charismatic executive editor who was also kind of a sadist. And to watch him taking people apart was, I mean, it was as dramatic as Providence. It was as dramatic as Harvard. It was like the third thing that I experienced. And even as I was suffering under the reign of this editor, I thought, I'm going to get his number. It took me 20 years, but I got it.
That's intriguing to see the gestation period.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, what drops out is the mean-spiritedness. The revenge motive drops out, and it just becomes interesting. I don't know if I would want to write in the heat of the moment ever.
When you come to Wilkes University, what kinds of things will you want these aspiring writers to hear about?
Well, I would think if they're coming from central or the middle of either central or northern or western Pennsylvania, they're probably coming from a place a lot like Providence. So I think they'll understand, you know, I haven't decided what I'm going to read, but I think they'll get it. And I think to give them a sense that they probably have more to write about than if they grew up in New York City, they'll have less of a generic televisual milieu. They'll have something. So I will certainly encourage them in that way.
And in some of the things that I've read online from you, at least twice, but maybe more, you've used the word hope. What is the importance of literature for us? It may be the same perennially, but now.
Well, that's an interesting question. And I often, when I'm teaching graduate students, I often say to them, you have to offer something to the reader. You can't just say, this is how bad things are. You have to not so much offer a solution, but you have to offer your own view, you have to put something of yourself into the story that the reader can glean. And that is the hopeful. That's one of the sources of hope. One of the others is that writing of fiction and poetry has a companionate function where you think, gee, I thought I was alone in this, but as I'm reading this, I realize not only somebody has been through this, but they have been able to describe it to me and help me to understand what happened. I think that's central, because I think what art does is it tries to make some sense of experience. And I think that there's great comfort in that. I mean, that's why I'm a reader. I have complete belief in that. I don't have any doubts that's the way it works.
Award-winning writer Jean McGarry, from the faculty at Johns Hopkins University. She will be the featured author when the Wilkes University English Department hosts the Allen Hamilton Dixon Fund Spring Writers Series this Tuesday, April 17th. The reading will take place at 6 in the evening in the Kirby Hall Salon, 202 South River Street in Wilkes-Barre. The event is free and open to the public. Jean McGarry will read from her work, and she'll discuss her creative process. For more information on the web, wilkes.edu, wilkes.edu. That's Jean McGarry, an award-winning writer, and she will be featured as part of the Allen Hamilton Dixon Fund Spring Writers Series on Tuesday, April 17th at 6 in the evening in the Kirby Hall Salon, 202 South River Street in Wilkes-Barre. The event is free and open to the public. That's Wilkes University's English Department presenting this Writers Series. And for more information on the web, wilkes.edu. Wilkes.edu.